I have a message from another time. Avery Productions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features, Future Imperfect, Symphony of the Sword No. 2, Year's End Confrontation Blues by Benjamin D. Hutchins. Hi, that'd be me. Friday, December 30th, 2405, 12:17 p.m., 105 Morgan Lane, New Avalon, Zeta Cygni. Caitlin Hutchins was in the dojo behind her house, the place where she had spent countless hours learning the Asagiri Katsujin Kenryu from her father. With her parents at work and much of the vacationing duelist contingent out exploring the city, she'd decided to put an edge on her appetite for lunch with a bit of a workout. This week, for the first time, she'd worked in this dojo as a master, rather than a student. Her father, who had taught her, looked in now and then, nodding and humming with approval, but for the most part he stayed away. He knew being scrutinized by her own teacher could make Kate nervous, and this early into her teaching career he was inclined to cut her a little slack. Still, he was impressed. She'd adapted well to the unaccustomed role of teacher, handling her first student with just the right mixture of firmness, harshness, and kindness. She was helped somewhat by the fact that the student, Kyoichi Sayanji, was not starting from scratch. He was an experienced kendoka, and his skills were making the transition from kendo to kenjutsu with relative ease. When they'd started back in June, he'd tried to spout some silly nonsense about erasing the slate and starting over, abandoning what he felt was a hopelessly compromised kendo technique, but Kate would have none of it. The essence of Katsujin Kenryu, she insisted, was building on one's strengths, and Sayonji's previous kendo experience was one of his greater ones. Abandoning it and starting over from scratch was both impossible and against his new form's philosophy. Faced with this pronouncement from his new sensei, Sayonji had made no demur. He merely nodded, said, "As you say, sensei," and they began. Now, 6 months later, Caitlin was mentally revising her estimate. She'd told him when she'd taken him on that his progress would necessarily be slowed by the fact that the two of them had far from the amount of time necessary for a proper apprenticeship. Her estimate at the time was that he wouldn't even progress to the journeyman stage before they graduated from high school in the spring of 2407. So adaptable had his old technique proven, though, once his mind was opened enough to admit the possibility of salvaging and integrating it, that Kate was now satisfied he would be ready to test for journeyman this spring, possibly before the end of the school year. That would have to be done by, or at least with the direct consent of, her father, the Oo-sensei. But she was confident now that Sayanji could do it. She didn't share that with him, of course. Part of the fun of being sensei was that you didn't have to tell the student anything. Sergei the tiger yawned, rested his head on his forepaws, and watched his mistress and her student spar. Sayanji, in his usual dark blue gi and hakama, his long green hair drawn back into a ponytail, was wielding the intricately carved bokuto she'd given him for Christmas. Kate, in her orange and black, held her zatoichi, its blade still hidden within its covering of dark wood. The wooden surfaces clacked rhythmically. The only other sounds were their measured breathing and the shuffle, thump of their bare feet on the dojo's wooden floor. Then, in a quiet, matter-of-fact tone, Sayanji spoke. "You're a little off today, sensei." Kate blocked his counterstrike, whirled her weapon out of battery, and stepped off, bowing.
You're right, she told him, nodding. "I'm distracted. Maybe we should break for lunch."
Sayanji nodded, bowed, and then went to the table along one wall. He wiped down his bokuto and racked it, then picked up a couple of towels, draping one around his neck and taking the other to Caitlin.
Worried about Tenjo and your brother? He asked as they left the dojo. Kate nodded. They should have been home by now. She opened the door and stepped outside, Serge immediately springing to follow. Even in her current worried state, the sight of the juvenile Neo-Tiger following loyally at her side brought a little smile to Kate's face. Sionji shrugged. Perhaps they ran out of time before they ran out of amusements yesterday, and decided to make 2 days of it. They would have called, Kate replied. The trio entered the house through the back door, shutting it behind them. Kate and Sionji took off their shoes, then went down the hall and into the living room. No one seemed to be home yet. I'm sure they would have called if they were in trouble, too, Sionji said reasonably. If you want, though, I can call Wakaba and have her group start looking for them. The Museum of Science isn't far from the monolith. They could start there and see what they can come up with. Kate shook her head. No, you're right. I'm just fretting for no reason. Sionji frowned thoughtfully and didn't reply. He was thinking that Kate had a very good reason to fret, but he wasn't about to say that, so he remained silent. There was the sound of a key in a lock, and both Kate and Sionji turned expectantly toward the front door. Presently, it opened, and in came Kate's half-brother, Corwin Ravenhair, and her roommate, Utena Tenjo. Kate's first reaction was relief, followed immediately by a surge of renewed concern as she got a good look at them. They looked awful. Pale-faced and tired, with dark-rimmed eyes and an overall look of shell-shock. Corwin had a bruise at the corner of his mouth and a black eye. Nothing seemed to be physically wrong with Utena, but she looked so weary. And yet, they were both smiling, as if glad to be out in the daylight after a long, dark night. "We're home," said Corwin with a wan grin. Sionji made lunch, drawing upon his half-year's experience as a short-order cook at the old Worcester Preparatory Institute's snack bar, while Caitlin installed her two best friends in the den and fussed over them. Corwin seemed a bit embarrassed to be the focus of such concern, and repeatedly insisted that he was all right, that it looked much worse than it was. Presently, just to satisfy his sister's insistent worry, he said he would go down to his workshop and perform a medical scan to prove that he'd suffered no permanent harm. Kate and Utena both knew it was just an excuse to give them some time to themselves, and both were unspokenly grateful as he entered the elevator and disappeared. As soon as he was gone, Kate gave Utena a look of such concentrated concern that the pink-haired duelist chuckled a little. Serge, who seemed to be picking up on his mistress's state of mind, climbed up onto the sofa, dropped his head in Utrina's lap, and said, "I'm all right, Kate," Utena insisted, petting the tiger's head. "We're all right." Kate sat down opposite the tiger and took her roommate's hand, looking at her steadily. Are you sure? She asked quietly. Utena nodded, her face serious. "Last night I had a flashback to that time by the amusement park. It was nobody's fault, just one of those things. Corwin helped me through it. I'm okay. I'll be okay." Kate, who knew just what time Utena meant, nodded gravely, squeezing her hand. Serge, who didn't, leaned a little closer anyway, making her smile and ruffle his ears. What happened to Corwin's face? Kate wondered. I hit him. Utena put her free hand behind her head and looked sheepish. Like I said, though, it wasn't anyone's fault. We're okay. In fact, I think, in a way, I think we're better than we were before.
There were obviously a lot of further questions Kate would have liked to have asked, and Utena intended to give her the answers, but not here, not right now, and Kate somehow understood that. With the initial worry out of the way, she could let it rest until her roommate was prepared to give her the full story. She gave Utena's hand one last gratefully returned squeeze, then let it go and smiled at Serge.
"You're a good boy," she told him, petting him. "Watching out for your friends,
replied Serge, closing his eyes contentedly.
Utena laughed. "What a ham," she said. "Reminds me of Nall. Where is the little snowball, anyway?"
"He went to the Museum of Science with Wakaba," said Kate. "He's taken kind of a shine to her lately.
Utena snorted with mock disgust.
"Disloyal little weenie," she observed.
The elevator came, and Corwin emerged, having dabbed a bit of disinfectant on his cut lip and rebandaged his finger. Kate just noticed the dressing and added it to her list of things to wonder about. He gave them a querying look, got a bright smile from Utena in response, and nodded. Nothing more need be said.
Sionji entered the den from the hall door, looking slightly amused.
"I've been relieved," he announced. "Aunt Beldandy has just arrived, heard my report, and deemed my own lunch efforts unworthy of the occasion. Even though I have no idea what the occasion actually is, and as far as I can tell, neither has she," he added dryly.
"Aw, poor guy," said Utena, grinning. "If it makes you feel any better, I'd have eaten whatever you were cooking gladly. I mean, it isn't Aunt Belle's, sure, but I like your cooking."
Sionji smiled. "Well, thank you," he said.
After lunch, Kate and Sionji returned to the dojo. Utena, Corwin, and Belle went down to one of the big, hangar-like rooms in Corwin's underground workshop complex, where Belle and her favorite, only, nephew were, off and on, working on the restoration of an antique car. Beldandy Wishbringer hadn't always been a car fan. When she'd first come to Midgard back in the mid-2100s, she'd been pretty much ignorant of them. Oh, they had them in Asgard, her homeland, but there they were mainly toys, not necessary for transportation, and Belle had never had much interest in them. That all changed when she met and started living with Keiichi Morisato, who at the time was an undergraduate student at the Nekomi Institute of Technology on Tomodachi. Keiichi, a sophomore at the time of their meeting, was a key member of the NIT Motor Club, a gearhead of the First Order, and in his company Belle had been faced with the choice of learning to love cars, motorcycles, and other powered contraptions the way he did, or resigning herself to being an outsider in that major, important part of his life forever. She'd chosen the first option and never regretted it. In addition to bringing her closer to Keiichi and his friends, making her more a part of his life, it had also brought her closer to her younger sister, Skuld, who loved automobiles, and all other mecha, with a passion. Today, Belle's collection of racing and vintage motor vehicles was almost as large, and a good deal more eclectic, than her husband's. She had a special fondness for the cars and motorcycles of 20th century Earth, one which she shared with Skuld, and the two sisters were always on the lookout for some new piece of history to augment one of their collections with. Skuld had found this particular one, a 1966 Austin Mini Cooper, moldering in a junk heap on a planet without a name, only the interstellar cartography descriptor Outer Rim 03F8, a planet which was covered with very little but junk heaps, in 2296. Thinking that it was just the sort of thing her elder sister would like to have, she'd tagged it and sent it to her workshop in Asgard, where its slow decay would be arrested by the shop's mecha stasis field, and then forgotten about it for over a century. Recently, she'd stumbled over it again, much to her chagrin,
and sheepishly presented it rather belatedly to Belle. Belle had brushed off the delay in an instant, enchanted with the boxy little rally racer. She'd brought it to New Avalon as an excuse to spend more time with her nephew, and since they'd all come here from Titan 4 days before, she'd been coming by every day to do a little work on it. Utena Tenjo had never had much interest in cars for their own sake before, either. They were fairly rare where she came from, playthings of the rich and powerful. Her family had been well off when she'd had one. She had faint memories of chauffeured limousines before her parents had been killed. When she'd inherited their fortune, though, she'd dispensed with the cars, dispensed with almost all the trappings of wealth. She often forgot that she was wealthy. Aside from her entrance into exclusive Otori Academy, it didn't do much for her. Earlier in the past year, though, Corwin, with help from his uncle, had taught her to drive, and along with those skills he'd infected her with his appreciation of automobiles, inherited from his parents and aunt. So during this vacation she'd been down there too, helping out, passing tools, hunting for parts. The work didn't interest her all that much. She preferred driving cars to working on them. But it was a nice way to spend time with Corwin and Aunt Belle, and she didn't mind getting her hands dirty. They'd been at work for an hour or two when the sound of the elevator arriving at their workspace surprised all three of them. Who was looking for them that wouldn't just use the intercom? They were surprised to see the little red-headed form of Vigdis Brightblade emerge from the elevator car, looking determined. Corwin glanced up from the Mini's engine compartment, blinked, and murmured under his breath, "Uh-oh." "Oh, hello, Vigdis," said Belle Dandy brightly. "I didn't know you were in New Avalon for the holidays." "I'm staying with my friend Clarissa," Vigdis told her. "Her parents live not far from here." "Oh, well, that's nice," said Belle. "Were you looking for me?" "Actually, no," said Vigdis. "I have two errands. One..." She reached into the bomber jacket she was wearing, took out an envelope, and said, "This is a message for Clarissa's sister Liza from her father. I understand she's staying here?" Utena, whose hands were cleanest, wiped them for good measure on a rag before holding out a hand for the letter. "Yep, she's out right now. She and a bunch of the others are at the Museum of Science, or maybe they're at the movies by now. Banking a day of it anyway, you know." She was determined to be civil, even though the little redhead had gone out of her way to snub Utena every time they'd met. Now, Vigdis looked a bit reluctant to entrust her errand to the pink-haired duelist, but looking at Corwin's hands and those of Belle Dandy, she decided she didn't have much choice and handed the envelope over. "What's the second one?" Corwin wondered. Vigdis turned to answer him, then seemed to notice his face for the first time. Her green eyes widened in surprise and shock as she took a good hard look at him. Like Utena, he'd been given the option of sitting out this afternoon's work session, but he'd insisted that he was fine, and getting back into the regular swing of things was exactly what he needed. But he still looked shell-shocked and battered, and the grease on one cheek emphasized the fact that he was still quite pale where he wasn't bruised. The Valkyrie's eyes flicked from him to Utena and back again several times, taking in the similarity of their dark-rimmed eyes and subdued looks, and cold dread stilled her heart momentarily. "No, oh no," she thought. "There must be some other explanation. Calm, Vigdis, calm, there must be." I'm looking for Skuld," she said, trying to sound natural and mostly failing. "She wanted to meet with me tomorrow, but since I was in the neighborhood, I thought I'd take care of it today." "Oh dear, that's too bad," said Belle. "She's gone out with the others, I'm afraid. They won't be back until late tonight. Past your bedtime, I'm sure." "With all respect, Lady Vertandi, I haven't a bedtime," Vigdis replied archly. "I'm not a child." "Of course," Belle replied mildly. "Forgive me." "She does want to talk to you pretty bad," Corwin noted. She was fretting about it the other day. What did you do?
How should I know? Vigdis snapped. So far as I know, nothing. Oh, well. If she's not here, I'll have to wait until tomorrow to find out, I suppose.
Well, hang on, said Corwin, wiping his hands. Let me go see if I can get her on her cell phone. She really does want to talk to you. He turned and handed the wrench he was holding to Utrina. Their hands brushed slightly as he did so, and at the same moment they made eye contact and exchanged a brief smile. She watched him most of the way to the door before turning her attention back to what she'd been doing before. Vigdis fought to keep her composure. That clinched it. That little touch, that look, she'd finally done it. The last step, the ultimate seal on the wicked spell she'd woven on Corwin's soul. That's why he looked so wrung out and drained. Oh, All-Father, it was too late. No, not too late, not quite. Too late to preserve his cruelly stolen purity, but not, perhaps, quite too late to rescue his soul from her web of evil.
I want to talk to you for a moment, Vigdis said to Utrina, her voice tight with indignation. In private.
Utrina gave her a funny look, then put the wrench down and followed her across the work bay. Bell looked curiously after them, then shrugged and went back to working on the left front brakes.
What is it? Utrina asked, trying to be patient. You won't get away with this, Vigdis hissed, keeping her voice down for Beldandi's sake. The Norn of today was notoriously sensitive to interpersonal conflict. There was no need to stress her if it could be avoided. Confusion overlaid annoyance on Utina's face.
What?
You may have snared poor Corwin, said Vigdis angrily, but you won't keep him. I'll set him free from the spell you have him under. How did you do it? Did Urd teach you her alchemist's ways? Or was it the forbidden sorceries of Svartalfheim that you used to place his heart under lock and key?
Utrina shook her head, too exasperated for words.
Look, kid, she said, I don't know what your problem really is, but I'd appreciate it if you'd leave me out of it. I'm not going to tell you again. Corwin makes his own choices. I'm not involved. Got it?
The little redhead suddenly lashed out, her open hand cracking across Utina's face with a sound like a pistol shot, all thought of discretion for Beldandi's sake abandoned. Utina was so surprised by this that she forgot to be angry for a moment, blinking in amazement at the Valkyrie's ire-reddened face.
"Don't you presume to pretend that you don't know what you've done," Vigdis snapped. "Maybe you can fool the others, but not me, not Vigdis Brightblade. Hear me now, witch, and understand. You may have violated Corwin's body, but you will never own his soul. I challenge you, Utina Tenjo."
Utrina's expression lost all its surprise and puzzlement. There was no room in it for anything now but her steadily darkening anger as the Valkyrie's accusation sank in.
"Challenge me?" she echoed, her voice dangerously tight.
Vigdis nodded firmly, her Norse accent becoming more pronounced and her speech pattern more formal as she got angrier.
If you will not release your wicked grasp upon my beloved's heart by choice, then I will make you do it by force. I challenge you to a duel of honor for the heart of Corwin Ravenhair.
Like lightning, Utina's hand flashed out. Forehand, then backhand, she reddened both of Vigdis's cheeks in the space of half a second, sending the little Valkyrie reeling back, more in shock than pain. Her own face flushed with anger, Utrina stared Vigdis hard in the eyes and snarled at her.
Don't ever play those games with me. Ever! You understand?
Then she turned on her heel and started stalking away. Vigdis blinked, then regrouped herself.
You dare?
She squeaked, then caught herself and forced her voice into a more threatening register.
You dare to strike a Valkyrie? You turn your back on a Valkyrie's challenge?
She thrust her open hand into the air. Varnigard! She shrilled, and a splinter of light resolved itself into a glittering silver saber in her hand. With a snarling howl of challenge, the enraged young demigoddess launched herself at her departing foe. Utena, realizing that she was being attacked, whirled, her duelist's finery replacing her oily coverall in a shower of golden sparks, the thorn of the rose almost leaping into her hand. But Vornegard's edge meant not the thorn, but a far different weapon, stopping with a ringing clang. Standing between Vigdis and Utna, the torque wrench in her hand easily blocking the Valkyrie's blade, was Beltandi Morisato, and she did not look amused. In fact, with that much outrage in her normally benevolent eyes, she managed to look downright intimidating, even in a grease-stained motor club coverall. Vigdis! She barked, her voice crackling with anger. What is the meaning of this? Vigdis stumbled back, appalled that she had just, however inadvertently, raised her weapon to the Norn of today. Falling to one knee, she laid her saber across at Bell's feet, bent her head, and replied, Mistress of the World Tree, hear my plea! Go on, Bell replied. Lady Vertandi, the witch Tenjo has laid a foul enchantment on the heart of my true beloved. She refuses to admit this treacherous deed, and so I must force the truth from her with my blade. The redhead raised tear-filled green eyes imploringly to Bell and went on. As a chooser of the slain, I have that right. Beldandi folded her arms and said in standard, Get up! Vigdis Altheana Brightblade, this instant. That is the most ridiculous thing I have ever heard. I thought you had more sense than to make a wild accusation like that, and to me, no less. Clearly, you're not sufficiently mature to be embarking on a course of surface world training just yet. Vigdis's lip trembled. But, Lady Vertandi... Enough! Bell snapped. No, Vigdis... You just attacked a blameless individual, from behind, with the intent of harming her, perhaps even killing her. It's inexcusable behavior, and it will not be tolerated. You will return to the heavens immediately and inform the assignment office that Goddess First Class, Unlimited, Vertandi Wishbringer Morisato has revoked your surface world training license for conduct on becoming a divinity, effective immediately. But... And... said Bell, as if Vigdis hadn't spoken. You will then report to the Allfather, inform him of your crime, and submit yourself to whatever further punishment he may deem appropriate. Now go, before you get yourself into further trouble. Vigdis drew herself to her feet, her weapon vanishing in a flicker of light, composed her dignity as best she could, bowed, and said in an only slightly grudging tone, As you command, my lady. Then her green eyes flicked to Bell's right and shot a dagger at Utena before she closed them, concentrated, and herself vanished in a play of golden and silvery light. Beldandi sighed, unfolding her arms, and turned to Utena. Are you all right, dear? She asked. I'm fine, Utena replied. Physically, anyway. She clenched her fists, almost quivering with anger. Bell made a dismissive gesture. It's all nonsense, she said. Then, looking concerned for the girl she'd just so effectively chewed out, she went on sadly, Vigdis is a very highly strung girl. Hopefully she'll grow out of it in time as she gains maturity and perspective. But right now she was too young to be sent to the surface world. I must be certain to have a word with the assignment office about it. She sighed again. And now I'll have to tell Skuld that I've just revoked one of her Valkyrie's training license. Technically, she should have been the one to do that, but as a first-class unlimited goddess I have that latitude, and there wasn't time. She shook her head. That's all really very sad. She's usually such a nice girl. But, as I said, very highly strung. Utrina looked at the spot where Vigdis had been, then turned to Bell.
"Send me after her."
"I beg your pardon?"
"Send me after her," Utrina snapped. "This isn't over. Maybe I'll fight her and maybe I won't, but what she accused me of, I can't let that rest. If I leave it, then I'll just get angrier every time I think of it. And wherever she is, she'll just nurse her grudge. This has to end. Send me after her."
The fact that she was speaking harshly to Bell, of all people, seemed to penetrate Utina's indignant haze then. She stepped back a little, lowered her eyes, and added,
"Please."
Bell didn't remonstrate. She just gazed thoughtfully at the duelist for a moment, then nodded.
"All right," she said. "I'll send you. But be careful. She may attack you again when she sees you've followed, and I don't know if there will be anyone around to help you. Don't let her appearance fool you. Vigdis is a very capable warrior, a fully qualified Valkyrie."
Utrina nodded, sheathing the Thorn of the Rose.
"I understand," she said. "I have to do this. Please explain it to Corwin when he comes back."
Bell nodded.
"I will.
Hold on. This may be a bit disorienting.